Welcome to the Leadership Podcast, brought to you by Life West, the Chiropractic College. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Oberstein.
And I'm your host, Dr. Mary Oberstein.
And we're excited to have you join us as we bring special guests in the world of health, leadership, business success, and chiropractic. Our mission is to create a brighter future for humanity, and we are thrilled to walk this journey with you.
Enjoy this episode, and thank you for being with us today.
Well, welcome everybody. Dr. Ron Oberstein here with you for another Life West Leadership Line. Today, I have a phenomenal guest coming to us from Atlanta, Georgia, actually Marietta, Georgia, around that area, Dr. Drew Rubin. Drew, welcome to the Leadership Line.
I'm so excited and honored to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you share your knowledge. And I just want to give our viewers just a little bit of a history around Dr. Drew. He graduated in 1989 from, at that time, Life Chiropractic College, where I graduated from, Life Chiropractic College. My diploma says that in 1981, but you're 89. Then he went on to Jersey. Are you from Jersey?
I'm from New York originally.
Okay. So New York, New Jersey. Went to Jersey, practiced there for 9 years, and then came down to Atlanta because he was asked to come down and teach pediatrics. So he came down in 2001 and been in Atlanta ever since. He's been teaching at the college, teaching. He had started a practice in 2001 at the same time because he just has to keep his hands on kids. He'll talk about that. He's teaching for, like I said, LifeU. He's also teaches for the ICPA, doing work with the Polyvagal Institute, done work with neurology club, neurology groups. He's just done a tremendous amount, wrote a chapter in a book for Activator on peds and pregnancy. This guy has done a lot around the peds and pregnancy space. And today we're going to jump into some pretty cool topics and be able to share with you some cool information that's happening like presently right now. But before we do that, let's just, Drew, just kind of tell us, like, you know, what got you into chiropractic?
You know, I was one of those miracle stories, Ron, where 15 years of asthma, puffing on inhalers, taking allergy shots, all that kind of stuff, nothing was helping. And my mom, in my junior year of college, went to a chiropractor for back pain. And she calls me up from this office, and I'm on summer break. She calls, says, Drew, you got to come see this chiropractor. And I'm like, a what? Because I really had no, there was one chiropractor in my hometown, and I didn't know anybody who ever went there. I didn't know anything about it. Right. And she said, you got to come see this chiropractor because, you know, he says that maybe you have this sub something in your spine that might be able to help, you know, you breathe better. I'm like, oh God. I'm like, Ma, I don't want to do this, but she forced me. And this chiropractor like completely changed my entire thinking, because before that, I knew nothing of this whole holistic alternative chiropractic lifestyle. Everything was like pills. You're sick, you get antibiotics. You have a, you know, allergy attack, you take medicine. You have an asthma attack, you take an inhaler. It's just the way it was. And he taught me this whole other philosophy. I went back to school in my senior year of Albany, SUNY Albany, and without asthma, saying to my guidance counselor, I want to become a chiropractor. And they're like, are you kidding me?
Oh, what? Don't they take care of those sub something, you know?
Sub somethings. So that's where it started.
Wow. So did you
have to go back? Thanks, Mom.
Yeah, exactly. Did you have to go back? Did you have to go back to school and take more sciences, or what was it?
I was very fortunate that I was a biology major at Albany. I was planning on pre-med. And this kind of really kind of right turned me. That's why my counselors were like, wait, you just spent 3 years wanting to go pre-med and now you go chiropractic. That's just wrong, wrong. They tried to steer me anywhere but that. But I'm really glad that I kept this going.
Isn't it crazy? You know, it's so cool. You know, and I think the lesson is we should always listen to our moms. We don't have to agree with them, but we should always listen to them.
That's right.
You know, I think that's so cool. And it's really a clear, I just gave a talk today, a new hire orientation. I go on, I just do like 50 minutes, whatever, you know, and they asked me that question, how'd you get in chiropractic? And I didn't tell them the whole story because I was running out of time, but I basically said to them, you know, I didn't choose chiropractic. Chiropractic chose me.
Yep.
Perfect example, right? Like, you know, a phone call like that, you go in, have a major healing. And who was that chiropractor? You remember the chiropractor's name?
Yeah, Dr. Ed Zawacki.
That's awesome. Big shout out to Ed, because, you know, that's like a, you know, yeah. I mean, we never know how far reaching, right?
Right. BJ Palmer's big quote.
We just don't know it, you know, and now all the people you're teaching and touching because of him telling you the story and, you know, and correcting your interference to allow your body to function. It's beautiful.
Yeah, one person makes a difference, right?
Always, always. And you never know who that's going to be. So that's why we can never, you know, we always got to be not looking for it, just taking care of people. And, you know, as they move on, you know, it's such a, it's, I mean, we are blessed.
We are blessed.
Let's tell everybody we are blessed to be in a profession that truly allows us to live the life that we live, but to be able to help people and beyond what we even know. I mean, we don't know. You know, if you weren't, you know, if you didn't know Ed, he would have never known you and it would just gone off, you know.
Right.
Crazy. Hey, let's jump into some stuff because I know you're like on the cutting edge of a lot of things that are happening, obviously, from your teaching, you know, around the country, probably the world. And what I'd love to do is let's have a conversation around and talk to our viewers around the polyvagal, you know, theory and sure. What's going on with that and how relevant that is and how important it is. And it's just cutting edge, right? So share, and we'll have a conversation with that.
Sure, sure. So back in 2010, I went to an ICPA conference and a medical doctor held up this book, The Polyvagal Theory. I never heard of it before. And he said, we are all taught in chiropractic school that the autonomic nervous system has two parts, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And he said, Dr. Stephen Porges found out that that's not exactly accurate. There's actually a third part to the autonomic nervous system, which is the social engagement system. And this is especially important in kids on the spectrum. Now, that's been my focus for like last 10 years from like 2001 to 2010 when I heard this. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And because he said, if you've got to get the vagus nerve working with these children, and it's not just about the adjustment itself, like doing a atlas adjustment or cranial adjustment, although that's really important, it's the whole office has to be polyvagal centered to make sure that kids are not being in any way threatened, because if they don't feel safe, they feel vulnerable, and now they're not going to get as good a chance for healing.
Right.
And I read that book after listening to that talk, and I was like, oh my God, the relevance to this is so incredible. I've got to do research on it. And I've been like tunneling ever since into this.
Yeah. But let's look at that, because, you know, what he said was obviously, you know, we need the neurological balance there undoubtedly, but he also talked about the environment
mm-hmm.
and the environment being a stimulus, which stimulates the nervous system, which you bring a child in, you know, on the spectrum, and put them into an environment where the stimulus is counterintuitive to what they're used to. And the next thing you know, they're being set off. Right. And whoever thinks like this, you know, I mean, it's like, that's beautiful. So what was it that you got out of it? Like, as you dove in, right. What did you do? What did you change in your office? What were some of the things that kind of happened around that?
I mean, we made over time, it wasn't instant, but over time we made sweeping changes where the kind of staff that I hired, you know, has to be very patient centric and able to kind of change on the fly. If a child is coming in on the spectrum, I can have her, like my staff right now is very bubbly and, you know, outgoing, but she can go, you know, and be very, you know, calm and centered with this, with a particular little one that we see. So is hiring staff, making sure interns are trained to understand when we deal with these kids, we do not want to do sudden movements, loud noises. We changed the kind of rooms that we adjusted them in that are very sensory, you know, like very low sensation in that room. So there's no music playing. There's no aromatherapy going on. There's everything is all about bringing the calmest possible feelings to this child so that they are more open and receptive to receiving. Yeah. Because before this, if in the typical, like we had an open adjusting room, and there's all this commotion and noise and music, and that was just like blowing their doors out. It wasn't as effective. Now we're really tailoring it to each child and what they're able to tolerate.
Yeah. I love it. Cause you know what? I mean, to be able to be receptive to the adjustment, like you said, is like, you know, if you got someone in a hypersympathetic state, it's just not going to, you know, the results will be very, very different. Right. So how do you explain, like, to the person who doesn't know much about polyvagal, you know, or the polyvagal theory, how do you explain them?
Well, I'm talking to like a mom or a dad or, you know, caregiver or something, what I talk about is the vagus nerve, and almost everybody now has some, especially if you're in the autism community, has some understanding of the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve, we used to always think of it as the rest digest nerve, because that's what it was commonly thought of, is, you know, it's all digestion and sleep and all that kind of stuff. But they figured out that the vagus nerve actually controls a lot of the face and a lot of the emotion that goes into voice, into how the eyes are expressive, how the ears are expressing, et cetera. So what we see a lot of times in kids on the spectrum is their lack of eye contact and the lack of intonation in their voice and the lack of like being listening when their name is called. A lot of this is because their vagus nerve is not really firing. So our job is to get that vagus nerve to fire and then do exercises at home to keep it firing at home so that we see children on the spectrum who come alive after years of just being in their own little worlds like this. And they start to have eye contact, less tantrums, more calm. And some of them even start to have improvements in language.
Right. So is there any theories around why it's not firing?
This is a great question. I think just like Dr. Melillo, Robert Melillo, one of my heroes and mentors in functional neurology, will talk about, we live in the neurotoxic world. And I think that's the key, is that the toxicity, that the three T's that we talk about, I've been talking about four T's now, cause I've added technology onto one of the T's. Good. And I think that fourth T affects the others, right? Cause technology causes trauma, physical trauma, just sitting like this all the time. Right. Technology causes chemical trauma from the EM, you know, Fs that are floating from this system into our brains and bodies. And it causes emotional trauma from the bullying and the negativity and whatever that's on it. So I think the four T's creates this neurotoxic world that we're living in. And that is creating a space where our nerve system isn't able to fire the way it's supposed to. And our job is to really find the places of, like we call it lack of ease, right? Lack of ease, wherever that is, and then bring more ease into that in whatever, however way you're going to adjust them. And to me, that's the key with polyvagal theory, is we want to ensure their nerve systems are firing as good as their nerve systems can. Yeah. Because it's actually been proven that children on the spectrum, their brains and nerve systems don't actually have the same like neural connectivity as a neurotypical kind of child. So what can we do to improve that neural connectivity?
Right, right. And not try to make it anyone else's but theirs.
Right,
you know? Exactly. And I think that's super important because, you know, we should never be comparing kids or anyone to anybody else, because we're all unique individuals, right? You know, and it's what we can do with ourselves, right? When I say that, you know, when you talk about polyvagal and you talk about, you know, being able to increase whatever we want to say, the tone or the calmness or whatever it is, it's actually, is it stimulating it? Is it trying to up level it? Or is it, you know, because normally on, you know, sleep and digestion is a parasympathetic response, right? And we used to look at the vagus as that. Is it, tell me, how do you define it? Like, what are we looking at with that?
Sure. It's a great question. So the vagus nerve, there are two parts to the vagus nerve, which up until Dr. Porges' amazing research, they really didn't quantify it like this as well. So there's the dorsal vagus nerve, which is unmyelinated, which is more of the freeze response. So if you think about amphibians, like they're the ones who have the original freeze response. But that's also the response of some kids on the spectrum who are completely into themselves. You know, like they'll just sit there flapping like this, and Johnny, you just can't get a hold of them because they're stuck in that freeze response. Then you have the next level up from that. It's like a hierarchy, is the sympathetic nerve system. And some kids on the spectrum are stuck there. And they're the ones who are super like this, like they can't sit still. They're always angry and screaming and, you know, running and banging their heads. And that's kind of a child. But then we have on top of all this is essentially the hierarchy is now you have the ventral vagus. And where the ventral vagus is, now we have social engagement.
Yeah.
Now, like you and I are talking, and if I smile at you, you're going to smile at me. That's a ventral vagus activity where the orbicularis oculi creates the eyes to close and the facial nerve helps the face muscles move. And because you heard the tonation in my voice, your ears are working in a certain way and your heart rate and your respiratory rate are low and calm because you feel ease. But what happens if you have a kid on the spectrum who listens to the fluorescent lights instead of the voice and hears you know, other loud noises in the air conditioning going like this. And then, you know, they start getting frightened and someone's wearing this really, you know, like this big thing we talk to interns, there's no more perfume or cologne in the office because that aroma. So you have a kid coming to the office and they're going, and you're wondering what's happening. We're just like, we just said hello to the kid and he's freaking out already. And the reason is because you've dumped all this, you know, excitement into his nerve system and his vagus doesn't know how to process it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the key is the processing.
So how does it relate to the frontal cortex? You know, Heidi Havoc's work is, you know, about, you know, the effects of the frontal cortex. And obviously the frontal cortex is all about integration and being able to take different things and integrate like that. And when you have kids that are, you know, on the spectrum, you know, they have a hard time integrating, right? Or is it not the frontal cortex? Is it more the polyvagal response that doesn't even let it get to the frontal cortex? I'm just asking you.
Yeah, it's a great question. So
I got a lot of great questions.
Yeah, I'm so impressed. So when the brain matures, you know, when a baby's born, it's mostly a brainstem, right? The rest of the brain isn't working a whole heck of a lot. And then the brain matures from the bottom up. And then when it starts to get to the top, like around 2 years old, the frontal cortex and then the prefrontal cortex start turning on 2-3 years old, now you get bottom top down regulation. So that's what has to turn on appropriately is the vagus nerve is going to allow certain things to work. And babies smile, they learn how to smile because you smile at them. What about the babies who don't learn how to smile? Right. So the vagus nerve isn't allowing certain things in the ventral vagus to work. And then the top down regulation never really gets to work. And that's the changes that we see is when we start working with these kids, what I believe we're seeing is the vagus is now working. Top down regulation now starts to kick in. And now they start to become social because now you have a properly functioning brain in both directions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so cool. You know, I don't know if you ever heard the name Glenn Doman.
Of course.
Yeah. From Philadelphia. He's passed.
Child.
Yeah. 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 He was, you know, he had the Better Baby Institute, but he used to take care of all the brain injured kids. And, yes. And Doman's, you know, he was an anthropologist, right? He studied tribes and did all this stuff. He had amazing things around the brain. But one thing he said, my wife and I did a course with him 34 years ago. One thing he said was that the human brain learns more from 0 to 6 mm-hmm. than 6 to 60.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, right? Like right now, I was just the other day with my 16-month-old, you know, granddaughter, maybe 15-month-old, you know, and she's speaking words and she's really alert and she's just, you know, she's an amazing kid, but she already has the vocabulary is already there. Like mm-hmm. she's, you know, and when you see this, they don't necessarily speak it out, but you can say, can you go get, you know, go do this or, oh, there's agua or water over here. And then she'll go grab the water, you know, right. But they're not necessarily playing it out. And it's just so beautiful as you watch this, what you said. And then as it starts from 2 years and as it starts to come down and all those functions start to come in, it's amazing. I mean, the brain is freaking amazing and how we think that we can control it or do whatever around it, you know, and yet, you know, it's just amazing. And then when we do this interference, you know, and thank you for sharing that. I want to jump into a different topic and I hate to be abrupt because we could talk about the polyvagal theory for a long time. Right. But what I want to talk about is this piggybacking off of that. Right. Because you talked about how the function of the child is working and how the, you know, 2 years old to get to there's certain milestones that we talk about neurologically, right, that are clinically there. The CDC, came out with new neurological milestones. I don't even know what you'd call it. I mean, it was just like, you know, they're calling it developmental milestones. You know, right. You know, I don't know. It was a couple weeks ago. I don't even know when it was, but but share about that, because, like, you know, all of a sudden we're changing the game, and are we adapting to the incoherence that is happening on the planet? So we're just going to downgrade everybody to it. Or which is really just playing to the symptom and never looking at a cause, but share your thoughts on it.
Sure. So this paper, I'll hold it right here.
I can see it.
Came out in the Journal of American Medical Association a couple of weeks ago. And it's called Evidence-Informed Milestones for Developmental Surveillance Tools. And it was a stunning revelation because, I've been teaching about milestones for years, obviously, in pediatrics. And I always would say milestones are called milestones for a reason, because, like, if you know what a milestone is, like, if you're driving to my office and it's 7 miles from my house where I am now to my office, there'd be mile markers. If my office was that big of a place to go, I needed a mile marker to announce it. It's mile marker 1, 2, 3, 4. It wouldn't change. You wouldn't say, wow, this used to be mile marker 1 for, 1 mile left, but now it's mile marker 2. We decide to change it to 2. No, it's not. It's still a mile away. So for them to say that talking, which used to be a 12-month milestone, is now a 15-month milestone. Walking, which used to be a 12-month milestone, is now an 18-month milestone. And to eliminate crawling altogether, I'm like, dude. And so this weekend I'm teaching for ICPA, and they're saying, how do we talk to parents about this? Because we're seeing kids who are, 12 months old, who are hardly even crawling. How do we say that's okay now?
Yeah.
Where before we used to say, okay, we really have to start doing some special adjustment, neurological exercises, et cetera, with these kids, like I teach in my ICPA class. What do we say? And this is what I told them. I said, I'm always going to reference that there are new guidelines, but I'm going to teach you based upon the old guidelines, because that's what I've seen for 33 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I think was going on right now.
Well, Drew, I'll tell you, it's one thing to spread them further out. I could see shortening them because we're becoming stellar, we're just becoming more,
wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. To lengthen them, it's kind of like saying, well, you get 12th grade, we've now made it 14 because we got to spread it out because we're just not smart enough anymore. I will tell you this, this is really interesting, and I'm going to go back to Glenn Doman, because he was doing amazing work with the brain, of course, in Germantown, Pennsylvania. And it was like the Center for Optimal Achievement or something like that, Optimal Potential. But as an anthropologist, he was studying tribes all over the world. I don't know if you know this. He was studying tribes all over the world. And he got to the Amazon, where he was studying the tribe. And it was the first tribe that didn't have a written language. Very first. He had no idea why, but they just didn't. And then he observed them, right? And they were pretty much blind. Their farsightedness was just gone. I mean, they couldn't see anything up close, right? Nothing, right? But they could take a blow dart and shoot a fly of 100 yards away on a tree, right? And he just was watching them, and he was observing the village. And what he saw was that they never let their babies crawl, because snakes, poisonous spiders. So they were always on their back or their front until they were old enough to walk, right? And then they train. And what he saw was that he pulled into the whole cross crawl reflex of, when you do the cross crawl, it fires the right side, left side, stimulates the brainstem, gets it. And the optic nerve, of course, gets stimulated. And therefore your vision is there. And then he went through this whole brain mechanism around this and just saw that, my God, the most important thing for a baby is to crawl.
Yes.
Frontwards, backwards, and this is kind of crazy, but my wife and I, we did this course, and Doman was, he was bringing these kids that had brain injuries and all kinds of stuff and functioning back. Well, then someone said, well, what would happen if you had a well kid? So we started this thing called the Well Baby Institute. Yes. We went and did that, before, when we were pregnant with our first daughter, Lauren, who you taught. And they said, like, they have crawling tracks around the bed. So we had this crawling tracker on the floor around the king size bed out of Naga hide and let them sleep. You know, they can sleep on you, but put them down when they're napping. And, you know, you ever notice kids are always at the front of a crib, right? You know, put them in a crib, right? And their heads are, it's part of them over here, but they crawl from as infants, right?
Yes.
Let them move because that's that reflex that's moving, you know, and all the amazing stuff. And now we're changing the game.
Yeah. I think, the term that I like using is we're normalizing pathology. We're normalizing pathology. So from some of the letters to the editor and stuff like that I've seen based upon this article, what they're saying is the reason we got rid of crawling is because there's so many different variations. There's not one way to crawl. And I kind of disagree with that. I think there's one way to crawl and all the variations are showing some sort of functional disconnectivity that needs to be addressed. So you got a kid who's booty scooting or bear crawling, you know, or whatever, crab crawling. That's not just cute and, you know, how silly and cute that is. There's something, why isn't that kid doing the cross crawl pattern like all the other kids are? So we're normalizing pathology and it really scares me to think that this is now becoming acceptable to have this sort of stuff. And they're saying is because we want to have better early identification and intervention, but like, cause there's a video abstract to this. If you see that's what the goal is to have earlier intervention, but I don't get how I don't understand how that's
going. Earlier intervention by spreading it out further. That's like saying we want to get there sooner, but we've moved the miles. You know, 1 mile is now 2 miles, right? But if we get there sooner, you know, it's like, what? There's no logic. There's just no logic. And, you know, and I think that as, you know, I mean, listen, you know, obviously you're one of the top ped doctors in the country. And as we start to educate our parents about this, right? The moms and dads and be able to show them, you know, that you do want your kids crawling and, you know, the kids who crawl early. In fact, you know, kids who walk early, you know, they say, get them on the ground, keep them on the ground and keep them crawling frontwards, backwards, you know, all over, you know,
crawling.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you want them crawling and here and now we're saying it's okay.
I think what we're going to do, and I'm really glad we had this conversation because the parents are now just started coming in asking these kind of questions. I think what we'll do is we're going to say the difference between normal and excellence, right? So a normal child, quote unquote, might be walking at 15 months and talking, I mean, walking at 18 months and talking 15 months, but an excellent child, right? We're looking for the peak potential. I'm going to keep the original milestones as the peak potential kind of thing, which is the Doman idea. Yeah. You know, because he was always saying you could always make kids better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you just give him the environment to do it. Right. And if he only had chiropractic, you know, if he only knew, maybe he did. I don't know. At that time, I didn't get a chance to talk. I went in there. It was like the United Nations. Mary was there. My wife was there for a week. Right. And they had people from China, from Japan and Colombia. And they all had, it was like literally, you know, they all had headphones on and listening to the interpreters speaking behind it, you know, and I got there, you know, I was there for like 3 days, the last 3 days. And I was just blown away by what I saw. I mean, truly blown away. But there's so many different theories. You know, Doman, these kids are reading at 2.5 years of age. And yet, you know, Montessori says, you know, wait till, I'm not saying, I don't think there's anything wrong. I just think that there's different theories, you know.
Yes.
But I have to tell you, Drew, it's just been great. We're kind of hitting that time on our speed clock. Thank you, man. I'm going to bring you back on because there's so much more that we can talk about. I also want to get you to college because I think, you know, you need to, our students need to be exposed to the work that you're doing and be able to do that. So I will talk to you about that offline, but more than anything, you know, thank you for teaching the future generations of chiropractors and continuing in the work because, you know, it's easy to just get in front of a stage and, you know, or get in front of a class and teach for, you know, 20 years, 30 years. I'm not saying it's easy, but because it's not easy, believe me, teaching is a difficult, you know, it's a very demanding profession, but still keeping your hands in it, still doing the work, you know, so that you can take that to the classroom. It's a whole different thing, you know, and I just want to thank you for being the, you know, the doctor who's still got his hands in it and then teaching what, you know, and changing what he's teaching from what you're learning. So thank you, man.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I think I had Dr. Webster Larry Webster and Dr. Jeannie, who were amazing teachers and always had the hand on the cutting edge stuff as my mentors. So it was easy to do this. And now, you know, I'm excited because in a few weeks, I'm going to be speaking for Dr. Stephen Porges at the Polyvagal Institute. My goal is to get chiropractic to the next level, you know, pediatric chiropractic to the next level. So I hope that, you know, more and more people can understand the importance of the polyvagal theory. A polyvagal informed pediatric chiropractic, I think, is a super a next step for where we have to go.
I think it's a whole program in itself, to be honest with you, because there's so many layers to it. It's like, just, you know, before you even get into the office and what you want to do, just learning of it, you know, just the neurology around it is just phenomenal. So, hey man, I'm so glad you're on the team, brother. I really am. And I'm glad that kid walking around with the asthma, you know, with the inhaler, probably being bullied and yada, yada, you know. Yep. Thank you, Mom, for taking me to Dr. Ed, and, you know, and life just changes, and the amount of people that we change in our life is just beautiful. So thank you, Drew. I so appreciate you. To our viewers, thank you. A lot of jewels, man. A lot of jewels that came out and stuff that you can look into. And, you know, you'll be able to go into the links and be able to see all the things where Dr. Drew's at and be able to get some more information. But, you know, just know that we can not only be better, you know, it's not about being better, actually. It's just about expressing ourselves to our fullest. And whatever that is, that's not a judgment against anybody else, but our children need that. And it's so important. So thank you for being with us. These LifeWest Leadership Lines, we drop every other week. So, you know, share this with your friends and share this with people who you know need to hear this. And I hope you share this with patients, because, you know, they'll be able to hear some pretty good stuff that then you can then teach them around. But every other week we drop these LifeWest Leadership Lines. The opposite weeks we drop our Life by LifeWest. And keep sharing these, keep coming, keep listening, and just know that we love and appreciate you, and we'll see you the next time around.
Thank you for joining us today, and for the love, commitment, and passion you emanate every day.
Together, we know we will make this world a better place.